You're listening to the Big 3-0, the 30th episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. It's the 26th of July at, 5:06 p.m.?
That is correct.
We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people. So, Akil, how has life been treating you in general?
Life has been good.
Generally?
Generally, yeah.
I've
been getting my hands dirty, literally. Chaperoning certain wards of the state on grand expeditions in the North Shore Mountains. Would you happen to know who this ward is?
Ma'am? Yeah. It was an interesting experience being a ward.
Yeah.
Up a mountain. When all hope was lost.
Oh, no.
And I saw Akil and he gave me water. It was a good team building exercise for the staff at the Armand and Akil Show. We went on a hike.
Oh, it was a staff outing.
Yeah.
Is that expensible, do you think?
Yeah. We should definitely look into that with all the crazy revenue and income we are generating here.
That is true. Yeah. You know what? The $8.45 we spent on parking, I'm going to be very happy when I get to write that off to the CRA.
Just also the trauma as well.
Yes.
The emotional toll.
Do they let you write that off, though? I thought that was part of the tax submission process.
There's a new form for that. That was a good experience.
So for context, we did hike Crown Mountain last weekend, which is just very close to Grouse. So you can take the gondola up and hike from the chalet. It's a quick 9 kilometer hike.
Yeah. I took way too long coming down, but it was team building, so it was worth it. Sacrifices were made. These are the sacrifices we make to bring this show to you. Yeah. So keep that in mind as you're listening, dear listener. Yeah.
What do we have on the roster today?
Today we have.
By the way, just before you start, you seemed unsure of your last name for a second there, and I don't know if it was because of your headphones.
When I was starting the show,
yes,
yeah, it's just I'm having a bit of identity crisis. Today on the roster we have somebody who's not having identity crisis because he's no longer with us. His name is Jeffrey Epstein, and that unfolding saga. And I'm sure of his last name.
Oh, you are?
Okay. And some mysterious set of last names that are appearing or not appearing on the client list that nobody knows whether they exist or not. We do have some Canadian politics to go over, some BC politics, and then Ken Sim's latest antics as he enters his final year as our mayor of at least this term, maybe he runs for the election.
We're getting really local here.
Yeah, and then we'll talk about another city, at least in this case, a mayoral aspirant, Zohran Mamdani, and his strategies of...
So what is it? Does he have one or does he have many?
I don't know. But how he's running his campaign, we'll look at one of his ads and... give our comment, our expert commentary as veterans of many campaigns.
So I guess, do we want to kick it off, just jump straight in?
Yeah, let's do the cold open. I think people have heard this clip, but I think it sets the atmosphere of what kind of people we're dealing with.
Have you ever had a personal relationship with Donald Trump?
What do you mean by personal relationships?
Have you socialized with him?
Yes, sir.
Yes?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever socialized with Donald Trump in the presence of females under the age of 18?
In though I'd like to answer that question, at least today, I'm going to have to assert my 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendment rights, sir.
Yeah, there you have it. This is resurfaced footage from 2020 from Jeffrey Epstein's deposition. Thoughts?
And his first trial.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly has some, he has information.
Yeah.
Right? Potentially valuable, important information. Not as valuable as it is today.
Had, sorry.
In the clip, I meant.
Yeah.
Had potentially valuable information, not as valuable back then as it is today. But the implication is clearly that let's take Donald Trump's own words, right? And I wish I had a clip for that up and ready to go. But if you use Donald Trump's own words from the 2016 campaign, he says, "Well, if you're not guilty, why are you pleading the 5th? Answer me that one, buddy." So yeah, he pleads the 5th. Amendment to the United States Constitution, which it protects you against self-incrimination.
Yeah.
So it begs the question, I don't think the implication is clear, right? That Donald Trump was socializing Jeffrey Epstein in the presence of females under the age of 18.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. How does it work based on your knowledge, if he said no? What is the risk to Jeffrey Epstein of saying no in that situation?
He risks an additional charge of perjury, right?
I see.
Yeah. So if you say no, and then it's proven to be...
But if he's innocent and he says no, there's no risk to that.
No. Well, if that's the honest truth...
Yeah.
If that's the truth... Sorry, I don't know if that's the honest truth, but if it's the truth...
Dishonest truth.
If that's the honest answer, then there's no risk to you, right?
It's definitely...
You would only plead the 5th when you are incriminating yourself. The point of the amendment is that can't be used as a reason to convict you. They can't say, look, you pled the 5th, so you are guilty.
Yeah.
Right? The burden of proof has to come from someone other than the person themselves, unless they have willingly and under no duress confessed.
Okay. So definitely on the sus side.
Yeah. So what Donald Trump said is right in the sense that you wouldn't plead... You wouldn't answer a question, you wouldn't refuse to answer a question unless you were guilty, or you thought that answer would open you up to some sort of unrelated charge.
Yeah.
Right? Like something stupid like, I would love to answer this question about where I was standing, but I'm going to refuse to answer it because then you could hit me with a trespassing charge because I wasn't supposed to be standing there.
Yeah.
That's a stupid example, but that's something you might want to, that's more like banal, right?
Yeah, yeah. Were they trespassing on Epstein's island? I think he's the owner there. Let's listen to this whole conversation about this client list, right? You know, there was a big talk about a client list. So the DOJ came out with a statement about a month ago, and they said the systematic review revealed no incriminating client list. There was no credible evidence found that Epstein blackmailed prominent officials as part of his actions. We did not uncover evidence that could predicate an investigation against uncharged third parties, which is kind of crazy in a way because we have a guy who is known to have trafficked underage women, and then they can't investigate any uncharged third parties. So and any of his clients... are just mysteriously don't have any evidence against them. But
nobody's disputing that children were trafficked.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody's disputing that. Everyone accepts either they're openly admitting it or they tacitly accept that children were trafficked. But this statement just says that there's no blackmail from any actions resulting from that trafficking.
There's no evidence of it.
Yes. There's no evidence. Sorry, yes, that's right. There's no evidence of it.
Yeah, right. Which is very mysterious. But let's take a look.
But also, it says I'm very interested in the. There was also no credible evidence.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, credible.
The word credible does a lot of heavy lifting, considering the administration and their their proclivities to adhere to the truth and reality.
Yeah, yeah. And the shape-shifting nature of reality.
Well, but also because Trump in recent weeks has said that if there's anything credible in there, release the credible list. He's used the word credible or real or true or truth in this to indicate that there is a list that the Democrats have put together And then there is the credible list that his administration is going to put together. And then you take into account the, I don't know if we're getting ahead of here, but take into account the fact that they have been talking to Ghislaine Maxwell recently.
Yeah.
Right?
That's also super sus. But let's first listen to Kash Patel. This is a clip. So Kash Patel is Trump's FBI director. You know, he's come out and, you know, defending now whatever the Trump administration is doing. But he had a kind of different perspective on the existence of this client list a couple of years ago on Glenn Beck. So let's listen to his earlier, maybe less enlightened perspective that he put out there.
This clip is from December 13th, 2023.
So who has Jeffrey Epstein's...
Black book?
Black book.
FBI.
But who? That is...
Oh, that's under direct control of the director of the FBI. Just like the manifesto from the Nashville school shooting, yes, of the Catholic school. Yeah. We still haven't seen that, right? It's not the Nashville police or PD saying we don't want this out. The FBI airmailed into that operation and said, this is not getting out. Because they do that because this is another government gangster operation. All these local law enforcement communities get funding from the DOJ and FBI for local programs. And if you don't cooperate, you're not getting your $1 million for this. And you're not getting and that's a lot of money to these local districts. That's how they play the game. That's why you don't have a black book.
But the black book, it's not just sitting. I mean, that's Hoover power times 10.
And to me, that's a thing I think President Trump should run on. On day one, roll out the black book.
Yeah, yeah. So not rolling out the black book. It doesn't exist anymore. No credible evidence that it ever existed. FBI director, Kash Patel.
Yeah, he's literally the FBI director. You know, he says it's on his desk, you know. And of course you have, right? The attorney general who said it's when she was asked in February, are you going to release this? She's like, it's on my desk right now.
Yeah. This desk is a very magical desk.
Yeah.
It's on multiple people's desks at the same time. But at the same time, it's not accessible to anybody.
It's like the room requirement in Harry Potter books that whatever you want to find, you can find it. But you can also make it disappear if you don't want it to be found.
Yeah, yeah. I guess we've undercovered the mystery. The black book is in the room of requirement in Harry Potter.
No, it's on the attorney general's desk.
In the room of requirement.
Which is the desk of requirement.
The desk of requirement.
In the real world.
Okay, yeah. Okay, interesting.
The desk also is owned / operated on by people who are less than enthusiastic about trans people, much like the brains behind the room of requirement.
Okay. So talking about, the Pam Bondi attorney general. So tell us, now you're saying there was this effort to talk to Ghislaine Maxwell.
Right.
So what's happening there?
So there's, through this whole kind of conversation about Jeffrey Epstein and what his motivations may or may not have been, what his relationship may or may not have been, largely most people seem to have just forgotten that there's somebody in prison right now who's alive who is his confidant, his girlfriend, whatever their actual relationship was, alive and in federal prison right now, serving a 20-year term, Ghislaine Maxwell. So more recently, she, and I think through her lawyers, she first came forward and said she'd like to name some names, which is how you reach out to the Trump administration, right?
Yeah.
Right. You put out a statement saying, I would like to name some names, right? I would like to come forward. Pick me, please. And then, of course, the administration will reach out and they'll say, great. It's kind of like a mafia operation where they reach out and say, all right, what you got for us? What can you do for us? And then we'll talk about what we can do for you. So Ghislaine Maxwell, through her lawyer, says, I have names to release, right? And the deputy attorney general, I think his name is Todd Blanche, says, you know what? A witness in federal custody says that they have evidence. It is our duty as the chief or deputy chief law enforcement officer of this country to investigate what's going on here. So he schedules a meeting with Ghislaine Maxwell and meets with her. Now, we don't know exactly who was in this meeting and who wasn't, but the impression of it is not great, especially considering that in this Trump administration, there are people who are absolute loyalists. There's like no adults in the room, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So nobody knows what was spoken of in that. I don't even know. The United States has a bunch of like archiving requirements and record keeping things that political appointees have to do. I don't know if it extends to the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General. They generally don't get involved directly. So nothing they will typically be involved in directly will be like confidential in terms of like meetings. Like they're not actually interviewing defendants. Like it doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So I don't know what it looks like from that perspective, but it looks very shady.
Yeah, it looks like it's what Kash Patel was talking about, gangster government.
Gangster government, exactly.
It just sounds exactly like that, right?
Exactly.
Like they're saying, okay, you know, well, let's cut a deal here. Like, but it would be a really bad look. Like already she's under some sort of partial immunity. That's what I read.
Yes.
That's Which, already again, a bad look.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Right? What is that? What are the details of this partial immunity?
And then further, like, yeah, what is the, if he pardons her and she like names Barack Obama or something ridiculous or like Jimmy Carter, like, you know, I don't know. It's going in a very strange place. No, we don't generally.
Did Jimmy Carter die of natural causes?
Yeah.
Did he?
You know.
Or was it Barack Obama?
Yeah, we generally don't cover, you know, this kind of salacious to some degree stuff. You know, we like to talk more about public policy on our show, but.
And substantive issues, right?
And substantive issues. But this story is so bizarre from a governance point of view.
And it's compelling because this is the first real issue that has shown any cracks in the Trump coalition.
And the MAGA people.
Yeah, literally. Can you name any one other one where there was this level, this extent of
the other thing was
remittance.
Like H-1B stuff was a little bit, but this is like the floodgates are open.
Exactly. The H-1B stuff went away very quickly.
Yeah.
Right? Like very quickly. Elon had some like disagreements at that time and he was like, you guys are idiots more or whatever. But it went away very quickly. This is kind of sustained. I read an article, I think it was Politico, where they said that the Trump administration is paralyzed like it's never been. Like Steve Bannon said, right, the way that these guys work is they'll just create issues. So the media goes chasing that and the public goes chasing that and they forget about the first thing.
Yeah.
They did that with the Muslim ban, right, which they say is not a Muslim ban, effectively a Muslim ban. They did it with
immigration as well.
Immigration. They did it with they tried to do it with the Ukraine call, right? But this is the first time where their own supporters are trying to hold their feet to the fire.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And meanwhile, they're trying to investigate Barack Obama for all sorts of interesting...
Which makes it seem like they're setting up for that's the climax they're setting up for, right? You know when you're like reading a book and you feel like, yeah, I know what this is happening. I know what's going to happen, right? Like there's so much foreboding here. So with that like ridiculous AI video of him getting arrested in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feels like that's what it's building to.
Yeah, it's crazy. And Tulsi Gabbard, who is now the director of national intelligence, she's taken such an interesting journey. You know, she started off, she was a leader in the DNC. She was a moderate Democrat from Hawaii. Then she had issues with Hillary Clinton's foreign policy. So she resigned from her leadership role. And she felt that the DNC was operating in the favor of Hillary Clinton and joined Bernie and campaigned for Bernie and actually gave the DNC speech for Bernie. Okay. Then subsequent to that, she went and met Assad and stuff.
Was it subsequent to that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Because that was 2016. I think she met Assad in like between 2016 and 2020.
So it was after him ordering his forces to shoot peaceful protesters, the Ghouta chemical attack, bombing of Aleppo. Okay, good to know.
That's my understanding. And then she decided to run for president, and then after running for president, she endorses Joe Biden against Donald Trump, and then she gets put on a no-fly list, and then she decides, okay, I'm in with Trump now. It's just a fascinating trajectory. Like Kash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard, they're just like, and with Trump, she's promoting this idea that Obama should be arrested for high treason or whatever.
Well, she referred it. She's the one who referred the matter, right? So like Donald Trump can tweet all he wants. He can tweet an AI video. He can tweet. In fact, you know, the tweets and the truths, whatever he calls it on his made up.
Falsehoods.
Yeah. Falsehoods. that part is not actual policy. Like, you know, behind the scenes, there has to be like, it's in very simple terms, there has to be like a piece of paper that gets signed by one person, then verified by a second person, signed by a third person, and then it has to find its way to like whoever's going to action it, like put it into a computer, whatever, right?
Yeah.
She's the one who referred to the DOJ these charges or like these allegations of treason against Barack Obama.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, it's interesting. I just feel that the Hindu community is not sending their best.
Well, this is the thing.
In the Trump administration.
She's not Indian.
Yeah.
Right? Her parents...
That's why I said Hindu.
Yeah, but her parents are... it's also interesting. Like, her parents are like Hare Krishnas, I think, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any like Hare Krishna fundamentalist...
Yeah, she's an interesting person. But yeah, we're not sending our best, it seems.
Who else said that? I feel like that's...
Trump?
Did he?
Yeah, he said about Mexicans.
Oh, wow.
He said when they're sending the people, they're not sending their best.
You know, the more you tell me about this guy, Arman, I'm beginning to think he's not a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But okay, let's so anyway, this is an ongoing story. I feel like it's going to end with them accusing, and I don't even know how far law enforcement apparatus is broken down in the U.S., that what's actually going to happen.
Yeah. I wonder why Obama, it's also an interesting question, like, is it that they're worried about Obama 2028 if Trump decides to run for a third term, or are they just like Trump, Obama's like the most high-profile figure that if we arrest him...
Well, Obama is the was the first boogeyman, right?
Yeah.
Trump's political journey started with that's actually another interesting thing. It's an interesting look into how serious Donald Trump thinks this specific issue is, that he is invoking the first boogeyman that kickstarted his political campaign.
Yeah.
Right? His political campaign, for all intents and purposes, political career, real political, he ran for president in 96 and 2000.
Yeah.
There was nothing campaigns. Really started when Obama made fun of him in the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you can look at this situation and draw some conclusions about how serious this is to him, that he would invoke his first boogeyman.
Maybe like that's
it's such an interesting callback.
Yeah. Okay. We spent enough time on our friend Epstein. So moving on. So what's happening? Do you want to do one local story and then have an ad break?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So what's happening with, aside from Trump covering up for the crimes of a man named Jeffrey, who are no longer with us, he's also launched trade wars around the world. And as a result... Canada is trying to, Canadian provinces are trying to reduce interprovincial trade barriers, which prevent wine being sold between different provinces, which prevent, you know, certain nurses or medical staff in one province from working in other staff in another province.
Would the ultimate result be having been that each province in the country did more trade with the United States than they did with any other province?
And they had easier access to trade in a lot of cases with the United States. Like, there was less friction with a foreign country than with their own country. Which kind of makes sense in a way, because Canada is basically like a bunch of people who live along a line above the United States. So there's kind of this north-south geographic incentive as well. But let's take a listen to our friend Doug Ford, as he's meeting with Premier David Eby of British Columbia, and they're signing this free trade agreement between British Columbia and Ontario, Canada's largest province.
Tasting wine.
David, how are you?
Nice to see you, man.
It's good to see you, man. The best tasting wine in the country. Now, I know he's going to disagree with me.
Controversial.
I know, exactly. There you go, buddy.
Thanks very much, man. I can't wait to evaluate that claim. It's funny that you should do that, because I have
one
of the finest wines in the country right here. This is from Mission Hill.
Oh, I love
beautiful,
that. What a label, too. I'm a label guy.
Short winery in Kelowna.
Beautiful.
You should come visit.
I will visit.
Yeah, awesome.
That's great. Thank you, my friend. Excellent. You got a beautiful province. BC wine, and I heard, not from experience, BC Bud. Okay, they ship a lot into Ontario.
Rest in peace, Rob Ford. That's where you heard it. Armand, tell us about, first, actually, let's, before we dive into the actual policy and implications of this agreement, what is your opinion about BC wine versus Ontario wine, or BC Bud versus Ontario Bud?
Yeah, as a novice, I'll defer to the expert sitting across from me. My opinion as an outsider into this world of wine tasting is that I haven't heard great things about Ontario wine.
I'm glad you've been reading into the subject, because that is the correct assessment.
And it's kind of interesting. What I noticed is Ford had to say the best wine, while Evie was comfortable saying one of the best wines in the country, even though everybody knows that BC's wine is the best.
Exactly. Everybody knows that BC.
So it showed just a little bit of insecurity, I think.
This type of straight edged, you know, psychological analysis is what I really appreciate about your angle on wine stories.
Yeah, as somebody who's never tasted wine probably since I was a teenager.
I love BC wine. I think we grow some really robust grapes here, like the hardy Merlots, the ever present Cab Savs, if you will. But this is good. This is good. Because one of the things, I was in an LCBO, which is like the BC Liquor Stores of Ontario. And what surprised me was, I think there was maybe two bottles of BC wine, maybe one. And there were entire shelves of California wine. Yeah. And it's not even like you said, right? If it's the thing about just us living across the border, you go, well, yeah, this wine's from Michigan. I didn't even know they had vineyards in Michigan. What the hell is that about? This is from Napa Valley, right? California, which is quite well known. So this is, I think, an excellent step in the right direction. Yeah, especially considering the expenditure, right, on United States alcohol, which is, I think, $1 billion that Ontario spends a year. And I don't think that's not all going to remain within the country. But if you can get even a fraction of that going to other provinces, that's kind of the increase in interprovincial trade that we want. And that would go a long way in blunting the impact of this trade war.
Yeah.
In that industry specifically.
Yeah, I'm really curious about this interprovincial trade war, because all the economists and a lot of expert analysis talks a big game about how impactful this is. But I'm just actually curious, when the rubber hits the road, how actually does it stimulate our economy, or does it just get washed out with everything else that's going on?
It shouldn't be thought of as a fix all or silver bullet, right? It's not going to fix the reduction in trade in the United States. Most recently, the statement from Donald Trump is that then we might not reach a trade agreement. And now this is the thing, right? When he says stuff, there's often no real details into what that looks like, what that means. So he said that it might end up at a 35%. So I do want to talk about it, but I wouldn't look at this ultimately as a silver bullet, because it's not going to fix anything. I think Canadians are in for a lot of pain, there's going to be a struggle. The economy is going to take a significant beating. But this is more like sandbagging for the future, right? It'll effectively be like rebuilding, but it'll sandbag us for any kind of future hostile trade partners.
And good news in the trade file, I guess, or depends who you ask, but you know, we started shipped our first LNG to South Korea or something.
Yeah, South Korea, Incheon. It's called the something Glasgow, out of Kitimat.
Yeah.
I actually was looking at that ship and I was tracking it for a few days. I was like, that's kind of cool. I mean,
this is like giving us some amount of Forex.
Yeah.
Right. Which is what we need to buy all the stuff that, you know, that's surrounding us right now, all this equipment, all the things that are imported from around the world, or designed in other parts of the world, aside from Californian alcohol. I think shifting into that, I think we can talk about the story too before the ad break, is the cabinet shuffle. I guess part of it is the motivation is this economic focus, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so do you want to take it away?
Do we have a clip or?
We do have a clip, but how about we just have a quick little chat about it while the clip loads?
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, so I think the main thing is like Ravi Kalan,
yeah,
who, you know, there was a lot of talk of about him when EB first ran for premier, to have him being a challenger to EB, the only real competitor to EB for that position. And
height wise too.
I guess I didn't realize how tall he is, but yeah, he has been moved from housing into that particular position into the economy and jobs. So this is a bit of a signal that, you know, this is becoming an increasing focus for the province. And you know, I think before the show we were talking about our good friend Christine Boyle, who was previously on the show.
I think it was our first guest in this iteration of the show.
Yeah. And she's now a housing minister. And it is going to be an interesting dynamic watching her.
Yes, because she's housing and municipal affairs.
Yeah. And even housing itself is a municipal issue in of itself. And so she's going to have a lot of face time with Ken Sim.
Yeah.
Who
was the mayor when she was on Vancouver City Council.
And they did not have the best relationship. In fact, probably they had the worst relationship, to my knowledge, in my short, you know, 10, 15 years.
Legitimately.
Following Vancouver politics of any mayor and any city councillor. He was trying to undercut her and limit her power and limit her authority. And he even sued her at some stage.
Yes. Oh, did he threaten to do that?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was something. It was always insane. So now, she's now the provincial housing minister. You know, to some degree, I think people don't realize this, but cities exist as are legislated into existence by provincial governments.
Right.
Right. Yes. So there's a huge power dynamic there between a provincial housing minister and a city government. Like, whatever the city government wants to do, the province can be like, hey, we'll just like take away that power from you and do something else, right?
Yeah.
So
basically, earlier, right, the dynamic was that Ken Sim could just ignore her because he has the votes on council. He doesn't really need to pay attention to anything she says or does. Now he literally cannot.
Yeah. So it's definitely going to be very interesting.
Let's take a listen. I think the clip's ready.
The threats from the president have not only escalated, but they have started to materialize in economic impacts right across the country, including in British Columbia.
And to that end, Premier David Eby is switching up the heads of housing, jobs, and public safety.
You might have to shift some players to ensure that the skills that they bring to the table are meeting the moment.
Ravi Kalan moves from housing to jobs and economic growth.
We have to expand our trade infrastructure so that we can be, quite frankly, facilitate the growth of the country. I think all the provinces are looking west.
Former Vancouver City Councillor Christine Boyle is now in charge of housing.
In some ways, I think this can be interpreted as a kind of centralization of power in the hands of the trusted few for Mr. Eby.
Another major change, Victoria Swan Lake MLA Nina Krieger replaces former RCMP officer Gary Begg as Minister of Public Safety and Solicitor General. Begg is now Parliamentary Secretary of Surrey Infrastructure, where his riding is.
Mr. Eby is hearing criticisms with the handling of key security issues, whether it is law and order issues in neighborhoods like the downtown east side or the police transition in Surrey.
Krieger, a former director for the Vancouver Holocaust Education Center, faces several challenges. There's pressure to crack down on intimate partner violence, public street disorder, and extortion against people in Surrey's South Asian community.
I'm looking forward first and foremost to being briefed by my team at the ministry and to continuing the important work happening on a number of fronts.
The BC Conservatives say the premier is trying to distract from ongoing controversies.
Think about it, we're exporting jobs with our ferries being built in China. We have healthcare being provided by GoFundMe campaigns. There's so many problems in British Columbia, and David Eby wants to change the channel, so he thinks a cabinet shuffle is the way to do that.
All right, so that kind of outlines what the changes are to the cabinet.
Any thoughts on your side?
Yeah, I think moving Christine Boyle into the housing portfolio makes a lot of sense, considering her activism and advocacy for increased access to housing. Not to mention that her riding has, I think, 64% of her riding are renters. So it's a particularly acute issue for her, not personally, but, you know, like politically on a much more, it's much more close to her than it might be for, say, for Evie himself. So in terms of the changes, you got Nina Krieger as Minister of Public Safety and Solicitor General. You got Ravi Kelleher becomes a Minister of Jobs and Economic Growth. And of course, there's a new ministry, the Ministry of AI and New Technologies, it's going to be Rick Glumak. Yeah, what do you think about that one? Actually, we didn't talk about that at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know what is the role of provincial government with AI. You know, it seems like a good topic for the federal government to pick up.
To pick up, yeah.
Because they just don't have the capacity at the provincial level to do anything significant. But yeah, he can poke around, I guess. I don't see the
point. I don't know what he's going to do, but I guess if you want playtime, you can
Yeah, exactly. Because I think it's just like you don't want to have a situation where every province has its own standards and
regulation wise absolutely
approaches to things. So you really want just the federal government to come in and be like, hey, this is how we're going to approach it,
right?
And I don't think we have any, like, in general BC and Alberta, we have very different politics, very different needs, and it's good that we have different governments. But like regarding AI, I don't think there's a solution for AI that works for Alberta and doesn't work in BC. I don't know why we would need our own approach to that. But yeah, if you want to just...
I also just generally think that you don't want to, I guess, like a race to the bottom of, like, say, AI data centers, right? Like, who's going to build them, say, here or there?
Yeah, maybe that's the goal here. I was also interested in John Rostad's expert, what's it called?
Political punditry,
armchair quarterbacking, or whatever.
I did chuckle a little when he said that when he said the thing about people using GoFundMe's, which is true, which does happen.
We're going to talk about it, after the show.
But coming from him specifically, and is, you know, just the history of the corner that he comes from. I've talked about privatizing the healthcare space.
Well, I guess we have a choice between GoFundMe healthcare or Bonnie Henry to the gulags healthcare. I just love the analysis of politicians. Instead of like telling you what they're gonna do, they were like,
which is what they should do, right? He's political punditry, it's not his job.
He sounded like a consultant, like, oh, EB needs to change the channel here. Like, I was like, oh, is this like a
are you talking to a focus group? Like,
is this like some sort of like MSNBC host, commenting on Trump's like third quarter approval rating? But anyway,
Let's take a quick ad break. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil show on 101.9 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, and after that, we'll have lots more to come.
What a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh, yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town.
Knock, knock. Guess who? MRG Live coming right back at you, this time with a whole new list of upcoming live shows by your favorite artists. Hear this. Marika Hackman, Faye Webster, Empress Of, Peter Cat Recording Co., and The Rare Occasions are a few of the artists MRG Live is bringing to you. Follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram to stay tuned with all the artists performing near you. Did you hear that? Through the best of times, through the worst of times. Attention, attention, attention. All artists, zine makers, writers, musicians, community organizers, activists, anarchists, proles, punks, and weirdos. Now is the time to make your voice heard at the 3rd annual Anarchist Book Fair. We want you in all of your resistance to colonialism. We want to platform your rage against the current political climate and join hands with you in saying enough. We're looking for folks who engage in community building, mutual aid, active resistance, skill building, and knowledge sharing to table booths and propose workshops on October 9th and 10th of 2025. This is an anarchist space, which means it opposes hierarchies and seeks to amplify unheard voices and build communities of mutual aid and support. First come, first serve. 50% of tables reserved for marginalized voices. You can email sponsorship@citr.ca to state your interest and be part of Anarchist Book Fair. sponsorship@citr.ca.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening live to the Armand and Akil Show on CITR 101.9 FM.
So next up, we have a story about a young girl who had a rare disease. And she initially was provided her medication, which prevented her having or reduced the frequency of seizures that she was having due to her disease. But it reached a stage where the government gave a determination, because she does have a terminal illness.
Batten disease.
Yeah. It reached the stage where the government body, which looks into these things, made a determination that there's no medical improvement to her life by using this medication. And this is kind of what John Rustad meant when he was referring to GoFundMe healthcare, was because the family was put in the position where if they did want to continue this treatment, that they would have to raise the money via GoFundMe. Yeah, just the government. Do you have the clip?
I have the clip. Yeah. So we're going to listen to the mother of this child, and then there's going to be a description of just providing some context of what's happening here.
And it is now only 3 days away from Charlie's last infusion.
The countdown has been constant.
I'm really starting to feel like we're letting her down.
For the second time in as many months, Jory Fales has been forced to plead with the province to continue funding her daughter Charlie's medication known as Brineura, a biweekly enzyme infusion that helps slow the progression of an extremely rare and fatal neurodegenerative disorder.
We're exhausted, and we just want to keep fighting for what's right, and what's right is that her medication continues for as long as she needs it.
It's your birthday today.
Charlie, who recently turned 9, was diagnosed with CLN2 Batten disease just before age 4. It's the only case in BC and one of fewer than 20 across the country. For the past 5.5 years, the government covered her treatment at a cost of $1 million annually. But in February, the case came under review.
this is our child's life that's being decided. It's, you know, there's nothing bigger than that in the world, at least to me and her family.
Fales appealed the decision and then appealed to the public.
Please share this message. We really need your help.
Charlie was granted two more infusions, taking her to the end of March, and at the 11th hour on Tuesday, another extension.
Until June 28th.
Well, I mean, I couldn't imagine being in the situation of that family.
BC's rural health critic calling for a clear plan moving forward.
This is a dollars and cents conversation and not a medically necessary conversation. And unfortunately, the way it's being presented to the family is just terrible.
We'll continue to do everything that we can to support the family and ensure that the decisions that are being made around issues like these are done with thought and care and using the best evidence that's available to us.
And so the countdown resets, with time being the most precious thing this family will ever have.
It is 100% taking away from our moments with her, thinking, what's going to happen?
Kylie Stanton, Global News.
Yeah, and just the politician you heard, not just before the child's mother, Josie Osborne, who's the health minister.
Yeah. And they and that now, I think about a week ago, they U-turned and decided to cover the girl's medication.
Yeah, which led to a couple members of that advisory committee resigning in protest.
Yeah. And it's completely, I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but it just seems so, the way this whole thing was handled seems very lack of thought. And even the way it was communicated to the mother, they found out at the very last minute, and it was communicated to them via just a bureaucrat. It had already become a high-profile case at that point, but the health minister herself did not reach out to the family. It just seemed, huge communication failure beyond the actual, policy of it. Of course, we want everything to go out that can help the child, if there's even like a 1% chance it's beneficial.
And any of us in her position would do the same.
Yeah, and her family's position, right? If it's less than, like if it's not a 1% chance and we just know it's not helpful, and yes, then we sometimes do have to make tough calls. But if there's even a small hope, we all, we would all support that. I just think the way this whole thing was communicated to the family, it just doesn't fill me with confidence that, the government has my back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. What was your feeling?
Yeah, my feeling was that it definitely should have been handled better. And I didn't even know this until you actually mentioned it to me, that the health minister didn't actually call the family to tell them of their decision, right? And with something like this where it's not it's a life or death decision for this family, right, of their child.
Well, at least they perceive it that way.
They perceive it that way, yeah. And so because it's a life or death decision, you want to hear it ahead of time. See, one of the things you're saying is that we have 3 days to go.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody wants to be in that position, right?
Yeah.
Even in terms of like, yeah, well, she could appeal the decision. Like, yeah, but that's not your concern. Your concern is taking care of your child. So if you have to appeal, if you do all of this banal administrative stuff, right, you want to have as much time as possible. So you want the government to tell you, hey, a month out, 2 months, however long, I'd say at least a month, just to say that, hey, this is the decision that we've made. You want someone like the health minister to call you and explain the decision, what's happening. But it seems like that wasn't done. And every time I don't understand fully what the rationale is between the extensions.
Yeah.
Right? Was it that it was medically deemed feasible for a month, 2 months, and then suddenly it isn't?
Yeah, I think the condition reaches a point where they believe the medicine is no longer applicable to somebody in that state of the condition.
Right. And the contention, the family's contention is that they had studies that found the opposite from the U.S. I'm not a doctor. You're not a doctor. Yeah. So I'm not in any position to make a determination on whether this was right. But, I mean, from a from like the side of like our government representatives handling this in a way that's representative of the people that they serve is like this is done in the worst way possible.
Yeah.
Right? You like you never want to hear a fellow resident, a fellow human being make a public plea like that, that, hey, my child is going to die if we, the public, don't get together and put pressure on this government to do something.
So, well, this is kind of, I'll cover kind of quickly because we're kind of running tight on time, but our friend Ken Sim.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show. do come on if you ever listen, Ken Sim. But he, maybe because he's so upset about having to work with Christine Ball as Minister of Housing. I don't know. I don't want to.
Well, the good thing
I don't
want
to add punditry, unlike my friend John Rustad.
Another friend of the show.
Another friend of the show. But, you know, he decided to fire the city manager. What is odd? It's not odd to fire a city manager. It was done before, I think, when Vision came in and Ken Sim came in with this huge mandate. What was a bit odd about it was he's doing it a year out. He hasn't even got a new replacement yet. And so it's just, it's kind of a weird move at this time. There's also FIFA going on. It just seems from an operational perspective, suboptimal, because assuming, and Ken Sim just got, you know, shellacked in the by-election. You know, unless there's some super crazy vote splits, I don't think he gets reelected. He could get reelected, but I think, if I had to bet.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's very unlikely.
I would bet on him not getting reelected. And so whoever the new actual mayor is, they're going to have to decide, okay, this person's just been hired. Do I put my own guy in here or not? So it's kind of an odd move. City manager is a very complex job. It's probably the by far the most supported job in the city in some ways.
Yeah, it's non-political. You oversee the 10,000 strong workforce.
Yeah, and
of
you
the
deal
city.
With everything, right? Yeah. Like policing matters, sewage, you know, all these like really boring, mundane things. Curious gambit by Mr. Ken Sim as he enters his final year of at least this term as mayor of Vancouver. Did you have anything to add? Do you want to switch to Mamdani?
I just want to add that I don't think any of the things that you said, infrastructure is not mundane or like boring, by the way. Infrastructure is very exciting.
Okay. let's go. Next time we don't go hike Crown Mountain, let's go travel the sewage.
We're going to start with the steam tunnels, my friend. I'm going to show you just how exciting the infrastructure of a city can be.
Okay. Well, we'll be like the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. I'm going to be Raphael.
Okay.
All right. So I think we're out of time for Mamdani, unfortunately. Okay. Yeah.
It's a shame. The one thing I'll say about Mamdani, you can check out the clip yourself, but I would say that what he's been very effective at is, you know, for people who haven't paying attention, he won the Democratic primary for mayor of New York. I was going to say New York City. No, I was going to say Vancouver. He won the Democratic primary for the mayor. He's probably going to win the general election, though there's some weird vote splits. What I was going to play, and you can check it out, is he had these really well-crafted ads that were talking about small businesses. And he's campaigning as a socialist. He's endorsed by the DSA, but he's really promoting small businesses. And I think that's a really part of winning coalitions for progressives, especially at the municipal level. But yeah, let's wrap things up.
All right. Thank you for that quick nugget at the end. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Erman Gill on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. The music for the show is composed with the wondrous musical talents of Sarah Pratt. Joke to follow next show. Every note she writes is an exuberant gift to humanity, elevating our souls to incredible heights we never knew existed. We do have some awesome shows lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all our episodes on our podcast feeds. Thank you so much for tuning in and have a great evening.
And our next show will be in 2 weeks.
So...